From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. They say a dog is a man's best friend. Well, Roger Karras may be a dog's best friend. Karras is the president of the ASPCA, and he's written more than 50 books on animals and wildlife. On this edition of Fresh Air, Roger Karras talks with us about pets from the dawn of civilization up to the present. Coming up, religion, delusion, drugs, and morality with novelist Robert Stone. His latest novel is called Outer Bridge Reach. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a book today, England's Dreaming, the story of the Sex Pistols and the English punk movement. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The House of Representatives today approved a Democratic plan to cut taxes for middle-income wage earners. The narrow party-line vote came after the House rejected a Republican plan that would have cut capital gains taxes but offered no general tax relief. The Democrats' measure contains a temporary election-year tax cut for 90 million wage earners, a cut that would be paid for with a permanent tax hike for the top brackets. The final vote on the bill was 221 to 209. President Bush in San Antonio for the drug summit denounced the House action and promised to veto it. Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton is trying to put out the latest flare-up over the issue of his draft status during the Vietnam War. Ed Hula of Peach State Public Radio reports.
Clinton interrupted campaigning in Colorado to make a special trip to Atlanta following yesterday's blast against his draft record by Nebraska Senator Bob Kerry. Speaking in Atlanta, Kerry said Clinton was unelectable as the Democratic nominee because of his admission he signed up for ROTC to avoid the draft. Clinton says he has assurances from President Bush that it won't be an issue in November. Clinton also used his Atlanta stop to downplay a fit of anger he showed last night when he was told erroneously that Iowa Senator Tom Harkin had been endorsed in the South by Jesse Jackson. Clinton says he's talked to Jackson and that the matter has been peaceably settled between the two men. For National Public Radio, this is Ed Hula in Atlanta.
A federal judge in Virginia has issued an order barring administrators of the United Mine Workers Trust Funds from suspending health care benefits to 120,000 beneficiaries. Rick Mattioni of member station WVTF has the story.
The judge issued the temporary restraining order in response to a class action lawsuit filed on behalf of retirees and other beneficiaries in the UMW funds. The funds have a $100 million deficit because of a drop in contributing companies. The Bituminous Coal Operators Association helped create the funds in the 1940s. The Board of Trustees, which manages the fund, is separate from the United Mine Workers Union. An attorney representing the retirees says trust fund administrators were planning to start sending notifications next month, indicating that benefits would be terminated in April. A March 4th hearing has been set for an injunction that would prevent the administrators from taking such action. For National Public Radio, I'm Rick Mattioni in Roanoke, Virginia.
The stock market went through a mixed session today with the blue chip issues retreating from yesterday's record high. Analysts said traders were reacting to a higher-than-expected number of new claims for unemployment insurance. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 14 points to close at 3,269.45. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading of about 215 million shares. This is NPR. The Russian government said today it will remove almost all remaining price controls by the end of March. Igor Gaidar, Russia's top economic official, warned that the end of price subsidies will mean additional hardship as the country converts to a market economy. The price of fuel oil will be gradually deregulated in April. Gaidar said that retail prices for heating fuel are likely to increase by 50 to 75%. The music business announced today that it's going green. The Recording Industry Association of America says by next year its members will eliminate excess packaging from compact discs. NPR's Maeve McGoran has more.
Currently, CDs are sold in two layers of packaging, an interior 5-inch square plastic shell called a jewel box and a 10-inch long cardboard sleeve over that. Major recording companies will now begin to release CDs in the jewel box alone. The Recording Industry Association of America says it's making the change in response to musicians' and customers' concerns about the environment. The association estimates almost 300 million CDs will be affected in 1993 and says the change will save more than 20 million pounds of trash a year. But many retailers are unhappy with the decision. The National Association of Recording Merchandisers says many of its members will have to create new shelves for the jewel cases and will face increased losses because the smaller boxes will be easier to steal. And they say recording companies should pass any savings incurred by trimming packaging onto customers. I'm Maeve McGoran in Washington.
Lawyers for the bankrupt securities firm of Drexel Burnham Lambert today released details of a proposed settlement of the worldwide legal claims against Michael Milken and other former Drexel employees. The settlement would pay out $1.3 billion. Milken, who's currently serving 10 years in prison for securities fraud, would pay $500 million. He's already paid $600 million to settle criminal charges brought by the government. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Roger Karras has always been an enthusiastic animal lover. He's lived with animals throughout his life, and now at the age of 64, he and his wife share their home with a menagerie of 28 animals. Karras has worked in both radio and television. He was resident naturalist for NBC's Today Show and was a correspondent on animals and the environment for ABC News. In the summer of 1991, he quit his job with ABC to become president of the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, which is involved with the welfare of animals living in New York City. Throughout his career, Roger Karras has managed to write more than 50 books on animals and the outdoors. His latest one is called A Dog is Listening. Karras said that humans have lived with pets for thousands of years, but he believes we need them now more than ever.
The human condition, I don't care what anyone says, the human condition has deteriorated. We're less nice to each other. We're more violent. We're more rushed. We have less time for each other than we used to have when we sat around the hearth. And we're judgmental of each other. Pets offer unconditional love, no judgment. So you flunked the French exam, big deal, just scratch my head. So you got fired, so you didn't get the promotion, so you got indicted for tax fraud. Doesn't make any difference to a pet. Non-judgmental, unconditional, constant love.
In the beginning of your book, you say that animals deserve something called appanage, which you define as its rightful endowment. Is this another way of saying or talking about animal rights?
Animal rights has become such a polarized phrase, expression. It gets people at each other's throats instantly. Though I believe animals have rights, I firmly believe that, I do not use the expression because to use the expression is once again to throw down the glove, to challenge, and I don't want to challenge, I want to convince people to be nice to animals. So I suggest the word appanage, which comes from the French, which means provisions made for the second son. The first son gets the vineyard, the chateau, the title, the throne, the crown, whatever. You've got to do something about your second son, so it's appanage. It came to mean, in English, what is given by tradition or natural necessity. So whether you want to argue whether animals have rights or not, you cannot argue that they have natural necessities. Every animal has natural necessities.
And what do you see those necessities being?
Because we have taken the dog from the loin of the wolf and turned him into his own species and made him totally dependent upon us, and we are the pack leader because the dog is a social animal, the dog needs guidance, leadership, above all, love, and attention to its biological needs. After all, we created the dog. Now let's take care of our creation.
Let me see if I can get you to give us a very quick history of the domestication of dogs. And they come in part, or they come from wolves. What do you think the price of domestication has been for dogs?
Genetic faults. There's a whole long list of potential genetic faults in purebred dogs. The highest on the list is the Cocker Spaniel with 40 potential genetic faults. I'm talking about everything from, not so much in the cock, but everything from hip dysplasia to progressional retinal atrophy, to a floating patella, that means a wonky kneecap, to all kinds of allergenic sensitivities. There are 40 listed for the Cocker Spaniel, 39 listed for the Bulldog, and even for our beloved Labrador Retriever, that big, strapping, healthy dog, there are 27 different potential genetic faults. That's because breeders have not been careful.
What about the loss of brain power? And you write in your book that about one-third of the brain, this would be from the wolf to the dog, one-third of that brain is lost in domestication.
Yes, it is. A wolf and a dog of the same weight, the brain of the wolf will be about a third larger. However, the part of the brain, this is the important part, the part of the brain that seems to have been atrophied or whatever, taken from the dog, is generally that part that has to do with sensory reception and not to do with potential cognition, which means it may not smell quite as acutely, it may not hear quite as acutely, but we still think they think. You know, Marty, 25 years ago, if you said, my dog thinks, the scientist went, ha, 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 ha. Today, graduate students and universities buy textbooks called Comparative Animal Cognition, Animal Cognition, Animal Thinking. Today, it's not if they think, it's how they think and what they think that's being studied. We were right. They were wrong.
What about that early relationship between humans and these wolves that were becoming dogs? And as you say, it was really humans that created this new species,
right,
called the domestic dog.
In the Middle East, history lesson, in the Middle East, there is a small wolf. It's still found. I have heard them at night, not seen them in the Sinai Peninsula. They're still found from Israel to India. It is a subspecies of what we call the timber wolf in this country. The timber wolf here is Canis lupus. That little wolf in the Middle East over to Asia, subcontinent, is Canis lupus palpus. We believe that that was the initial animal from which domestication started. The initial domestication probably took place in the Middle East. We have breeds that go back at least 8,000 years, which are purebred, breeding true dogs. To have reached that point 8,000 years ago, it is estimated that the dog may have started to be domesticated, that is, taken out of the loins of the wolf, 250 centuries ago, about 25,000 years.
Were early people then looking for some creature to help them hunt, or were they looking for companionship?
I don't think it had a motive. I think it just sort of happened, and I'll give you a possible scenario. Well, obviously, I don't know if this is the case, but indulge me in a possible scenario, or let me indulge myself. Dogs and wolves were eaten. Everything was eaten, and everything they ate, us too, by the way. I'm talking now about very early Stone Age. And it's fairly simple for 12 strapping, hulking cavemen to neutralize a bitch and her puppies in a cave or in a nest somewhere with a hail of stones. So they crept up and they threw these whole big bunch of stones and they knocked down the bitch or drove her off, and they went and they sold the puppies. They brought the puppies back to the cave. And with lack of refrigeration, you didn't kill meat if you didn't have to until you needed it, because it began stinking in about 2 days. So you kept the puppies alive, just the way they do in parts of Asia today, in Korea, in the Philippines, in China. Then you kill them as you want them and eat them. They eat dog today, so they ate wolf then. Okay, Johnny Caveboy has got the measles, and he begins playing with one of the puppies that you haven't killed to eat yet. And when it comes time to kill that puppy, the mother says, oh, come on, you sloth. Go out and get something else. Let the kid keep the puppy. He's got the measles. The pediatrician says he feels lousy. Look, he's having fun. It's the first time in a week he hasn't been crying. Okay? So they get used to keeping a puppy around. And when it came time to off it a little bit later, the kid says, no, you don't. It's my puppy. Something like that. something in that corner of the room happened at somewhere along the line, and here and there people began keeping a socialized wolf around.
I'm speaking with Roger Karas, and he is the current head or president of the ASPCA, and has just written another book, and he's written a bunch of them, and this latest book is called A Dog Is Listening. Talking about dogs listening, and I'm sure anyone who lives with dogs know that they listen very attentively. What do you think they're listening for? And is it that they do see these people that they live with in this house as somehow their leader? And they're listening for commands, listening for so they know what to do next?
For sure. It is a madness to imagine a household where the human being was not the leader. Man is the alpha wolf in the pack, and the dogs are beta and so forth. They are listening for command. Now, I have 12 dogs at the moment. One of them is a border collie. Duncan's very famous. He's the son of Mike, and Mike was the dog and down out in Beverly Hills and many other films. This is Mike's son, Duncan. Duncan is a border collie. He is all border collie. And if you don't give him something to do, if it's something to herd, he'll go herd the toilet and the bathtub. He's got to herd something. So when my grandchildren are there, that's good. You can herd them. We got 11 other dogs. He can herd them. We got 10 cats. You can herd them. We have horses, but when he tries to herd them, he gets his head kicked in, so he's not doing that so much anymore. And we have 2 pet cows, and one of them's a steer. And
don't want to herd him, right?
The Steakums would love to make a barbecue skewer out of Duncan because he's a pain when he tries to hurt him. Yeah. So he hears as best he can, usually the other dogs. And he never stops looking. He never stops paying attention. Border collies never rest. He's a perfect, nice example of what we're talking about. They are listening for orders, for commands. They're looking for a signal to tell them how they can please you.
Let me ask you about the touching relationship between animals and people, or between dogs and people. Mm-hmm. And it obviously is obviously the basis for a very deep bond. I mean, somehow through this touching that goes on, there's this great bond that happens. Why certain places like the jawline or the behind the ears or even the stomach, why is that so seductive to dogs?
Well, can I back up and take it from us first?
Sure.
Without being salacious, I would suggest that touch in human beings is the most underutilized of all the 5 senses, if we only have 5 senses, except in sexual interplay. I don't know where else. Occasionally you may feel a piece of fabric or rub your hand over a piece of marble in a museum or something, but essentially, the tactile sensation is pretty much reduced to human beings to just sexual interplay. Then along comes the dog or the cat, and we pet it. We're using, not sexually, I'm not being silly, but we're using the sense of touch again in a different context. So that is pleasing for us. It is pleasing relationship. Dogs and cats have places they love to be petted, particularly the cat at the corner of the mouth, because there is a claiming gland there. When a cat rubs against you, it rubs its side of its mouth, apparently its cheek, against you, your leg, or your chair leg, or the piano leg. What is he doing? He's depositing an infinitesimal drop of a chemical known as a pheromone, which is a marking device. Other cats can sense it. You would never be able to smell it. But other cats can, and they know that that's been claimed, you've been claimed. So it's a claiming ritual, and nature makes things that are important to an animal feel good to the animal, so they'll do it. So apparently it feels good to rub your jaw or your cheek against a person's leg. Again, not to be salacious, dogs love to have their chest scratched, particularly male dogs. Why? Because when a male covers a female and copulates and engages in a pelvic thrust, its chest rubs along the spine of the female. And dogs can't scratch their own chest, but you scratch their chest for them. It's got pleasant associations. Now forget I said that and go enjoy your dog.
Well, I want to talk some more, but I want to take a short break. And I'm speaking with Roger Karas, and he's currently the president of the ASPCA and has just written another book. It's called A Dog Is Listening. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Roger Karas. Let me talk a little bit, if we can, about pit bulls. Mm-hmm. And do you see them as an overly maligned breed?
No. No, I don't. The American Pit Bull Terrier, APBT, is registered with the United Kennel Club in Kalamazoo, Michigan, just to put this in perspective. The same dog, and I don't care what the breeders say, because they very often double register them. The same dog can, in fact, be registered with the American Kennel Club as the American Staffordshire Terrier. It is a perfectly fine pet. It is a perfectly terrific dog, unless it has been selectively bred for violence. Viciousness does not apply. Dogs are not vicious. People are. If it's been bred to be violent towards other animals, if it's been trained to be aggressive toward people, it is a monstrosity and should not be tolerated in any society because it's a walking time bomb.
Well, are pit bulls any easier to train towards violence than other breeds?
Yes, because they have been for eons fighting dogs, and they're very easily turned into monsters. Now, if you gave me that dog at birth, and I was able to pick it up, hold it, and carry it around for a few minutes, several times a day, and then my wife did it, and our housekeeper did it, and my mother-in-law did it, and socialized that dog beautifully. I guarantee you, socialize that dog to be Lassie. If I'm heavy-handed, if I'm a lout, if I'm a real redneck with violence in my soul, I can very easily, with no problem at all, turn that dog into an absolute monstrosity.
You're talking about abusing the dog.
I'm talking about, well, yeah, but I may not be torturing the dog. I may just be doing things to the dog that make it nasty, like throwing kittens in for it to kill. You know, that's what the fighting dog people do. Let there be no mistake about this. That's the way they're trained. They're given kittens to kill. Then they're given puppies to kill. And then they'll take something like a toy poodle and dangle it overhead on a pulley. And the pit bull jumps and jumps and jumps and tries it. And finally, it gets a hold of the little dog's head and tears his head off. That makes a fighting dog.
Once a pit bull has been then made into a fighting dog, can anything be undone about it? Because we certainly read in newspapers about pit bulls having to be shot after they have attacked a schoolyard full of children. That was the only way to deal with this particular dog.
Well, the other way was to tranquilize it and bring it to a shelter and have it humanely destroyed with a needle. When the ASPCA raids a dog fight, and we do it all the time, and we get fighting dogs or fighting cocks from cockfights, we euthanize them. We do not consider that animal. I suppose that somebody who really wanted to love that animal could take it and work on it over a period of years with great care that it never got near another human being or another animal, and could possibly turn it into, a nice pet. That's being so unlikely the case, and there being so very many of them, they are routinely euthanized, and I would think that's the only socially responsible thing to do. They're turned into monsters by human monsters. Mm-hmm. The people who fight them and use them in fights are human monsters. They have no souls, or they wouldn't do that.
Would you say, and I'm asking you this as president of the ASPCA, that the people are learning to treat their pets, their animals, better? Are you think making strides in this whole sort of field of education about animals?
As compared to when?
I don't know. As it compared to a generation ago?
Yeah. Yeah. We still have problems. People still won't get their dogs spayed and neutered. They're still absolutely wacko on that subject. I think it's some kind of assault on their own manhood, a womanhood, or something to get dogs spayed and neutered. So we're still euthanizing a vast number of animals. They still abandon animals. They still allow animals to wander under circumstances and in places where they should never be allowed to wander. People who let them go in the city have not learned their lesson. People that don't spay and neuter have not learned their lesson. People who say dumb things like, well, we let her have a litter because we want our child to see the miracle of birth. Well, fine, let your child see the miracle of birth, then take the litter down to the shelter and have your child wait while they destroy the litter and let them see the miracle of death too, because that's what's going to happen to them. Don't take him and say, fine, my dog, a good home, and wink so that you won't say something in front of the child. Tell the child, we're going to have this litter, and there are no homes for them. 13 million were killed last year, 15, whatever it was. So we'll have this litter, and you'll see how the mother does that, and then we'll take them down, and they'll kill them. Tell the child the truth of what kind of a monster you are. What a wonderful lesson to teach children, that living creatures are plastic gewgaws to be thrown away when you're done playing with them, after you've broken them.
This seems like a very emotional issue for you.
It ain't easy.
Yeah. Is that the hardest part, perhaps, of being the president of the ASPCA, the kind of heartbreak of having to put down so many animals?
Oh, absolutely. We investigate cruelty cases, dog fighting, cock fighting, this maniacal thing called Santeria, where they bleed animals to death on an altar, some kind of voodoo ceremony. All of that is repulsive. It's infuriating. The carriage horses in the city, the abuses of them, and how difficult it is to enforce the laws and how weak and milquetoasty their laws are. It goes on and on. There are all kinds of problems. There's the occasional psychopath who soaks cats in lighter fluid and sets them on fire and throws animals off roofs. Those are anecdotal, and they're difficult to deal with, but we have law enforcement powers, and my men are armed, and women, and they can do something about that. But you can't do anything about a human psyche in this deteriorating human condition who look on animals as something to be tossed aside, thrown aside, abandoned, changed because the eyes are the wrong color or grew too big. We recently took in, at home, my wife and I, a Labrador Retriever. The people gave the Labrador Retriever up for euthanasia because they said it got bigger than they thought. Now I'm going to ask you, anybody who's so stupid that they don't know how big a Labrador Retriever gets, or who is so stupid they wouldn't bother to find out how big a Labrador Retriever gets, they haven't got a right to anything. They're subhuman. And yes, that's the hardest part, compensating for a deteriorating human condition.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today, Roger Karas. Thanks for joining us today on Fresh Air. I did have a question for you, but it's such a lighthearted one, I almost hate to ask it.
Ask it. Let's go on a high note.
Okay. I'm just curious how old you are in dog years.
In dog years?
Have you figured that out yet?
Well, by tradition, what is 7 times 64?
Well, let me pull out my calculator here.
7 times 64 is what?
You're 448.
I'm 448, but I don't feel a day over 445.
Thank you very much, Roger Karas, for joining us today.
Thank you, Marty.
Roger Karas' latest book is called A Dog Is Listening. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. Award-winning novelist Robert Stone took the inspiration for his new book, Outer Bridge Reach, from the true story of a man whose desire to sail around the world was his undoing. Coming up, a talk with Robert Stone. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker sings the praises of England's Dreaming, a new book on the rise of the punk movement in that country. And Ken tells us about his own experience interviewing the Sex Pistols' Johnny Rotten. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the House has voted on two competing tax plans. It defeated a Republican plan to give tax cuts to investors and homebuyers. The House approved a Democratic version, which would give tax cuts to the middle class and pay for them by raising rates on people in the higher tax brackets. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Both votes were along party lines. The Republican plan was defeated 264 to 166. The Democrats' plan was passed 221 to 209. The Democrats had trouble rounding up even this bare majority. Some liberals objected to a provision in the bill that would index the profits from capital gains for inflation. Others didn't want to vote for any tax increase at all. The bill now goes on to the Senate, where the Finance Committee Chairman Lloyd Bentsen has said he favors a similar approach to tax redistribution. President Bush has promised to veto any bill that includes tax hikes, and many lawmakers predict the outcome of this year's battle over taxes will be stalemate. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
According to a new survey, President Bush's approval rating has dropped 7% since January, down to 39%. A survey by the Times Mirror Center for the People and the Press found if the election was held today, Mr. Bush would lose to an unnamed Democrat 48% to 40%. However, the poll also found that 66% of those surveyed believe that once a Democratic challenger is chosen, the president would then be reelected. Germany and Czechoslovakia have signed a friendship treaty in Prague. Leaders of the two nations said this treaty opens a new chapter of good neighborly relations. But the agreement does nothing to heal one of the most painful wounds left over from the Second World War. Burton Bolag reports from Prague.
German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, who came to Prague to sign the treaty, said it meant a new start for peace and friendship in Central Europe. Czechoslovak President Václav Havel called it an historic moment. But despite the evident goodwill, the two leaders were unable to resolve the thorniest issue between them, the property claims of the expelled Sudeten Germans. 3 million of them were thrown out of Czechoslovakia at the end of World War II, and Czechoslovakia says it will not return the property they were forced to leave behind. So the Sudetans are protesting the agreement in Germany, but they're not the only ones. Hundreds of jeering right-wing and communist Czechs protested today in Prague. They're angry because the treaty does not expressly rule out restitutions. For National Public Radio, this is Burton Bolag in Prague.
In Yugoslavia, the president of Serbia has declared that the fighting is over. The expense of the war and a European economic embargo have left a fourth of Serbia's workforce unemployed and sent prices up 30% a month. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 14 points. This is NPR News. In Moscow, officials of the Russian government say that they plan to lift almost all remaining price controls by the end of March. Prices on many items were lifted last month, thus making many staples too expensive for ordinary people. The government says only the price of medicine, baby food, and local services will still be under state control. One Russian official said the measures are part of Russia's bid to comply with International Monetary Fund recommendations for a faster move to a market economy. Critics say the moves will push many people into poverty, and there have been demonstrations against the actions. The government also plans to use the military to transfer land to private ownership. Former Senator and Professor S.I. Hayakawa died today at the age of 85 at a hospital in Northern California. NPR's Ina Jaffe has more about the man who stirred controversy in education and politics.
S.I. Hayakawa was acting president of San Francisco State College in 1968 when he became a folk hero of conservatives. During his first day on the job, the 5'3" Hayakawa, with his trademark tam-o'-shanter hat, climbed on top of a sound truck brought on campus by anti-war activists and disconnected the speakers. He was elected to the United States Senate in 1976, but his political fortune soon declined when it was reported that he slept through Senate orientation sessions. He also angered many of his constituents with statements considered insensitive to the poor. And unlike most Americans of Japanese ancestry, he defended the relocation of Japanese Americans to detention camps during the Second World War. In recent years, he had campaigned for English to be established as the United States' official language. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
The government says that new claims for state unemployment benefits moved up again in the latest reporting week, up by 7,000 people. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Novelist Robert Stone has said he's always trying to get at some essential truth about America, whether writing about the dark side of New Orleans, war-torn Central America, or the phony glamour of Hollywood. His novel about Vietnam, Dog Soldiers, won a National Book Award and was made into the movie Who'll Stop the Rain. Robert Stone is an ex-Navy man who fell in with the merry pranksters in the early 60s and used a lot of mind-expanding drugs. He now lives a more settled life in Connecticut. His latest novel, Outer Bridge Reach, is based on the true story of Donald Crowhurst, who wanted to sail around the world and entered the Golden Globe circumnavigational race in 1969.
He talked his way into this race. He was really not a very good sailor, not a very experienced sailor at all. Managed to talk his way into the race. Once underway, he found that he was out of his league. His rigging was working itself into knots that he couldn't resolve. He just was not about to win, not about even to finish. So he began to send out false position reports, giving the authorities of the race to understand that he was working his way around the Cape of Good Hope and completing the race, when in fact he was just hiding outside the shipping lanes in the South Atlantic and hoping not to be spotted. And his plan was to continue this subterfuge while the other entrants sailed all the way around the world. And then he would leap out of cover. This was kind of a Rosie Ruiz, on a global scale that he was doing. And
did it work?
No, it didn't work. It didn't work because he lost his mind, perhaps from the math involved in faking his positions, doing algebraic calculations backwards, trying to find out what literally working the angles. It was too much math. He really probably wasn't capable of it anyway.
You've called Owen Brown, and he's the man in the story who decides, even though he's never sailed before, that he's going to try to sail around the world. You've called him the most difficult character you've ever had to write. Do you know what made him so difficult for you?
What made him difficult was that his circumstances and his are very different from mine. He's an Annapolis graduate. I mean, I was in the Navy. I went in the Navy as a seaman apprentice at 17. He is part of the suburban middle class, and that was not my background. A lot of things about him were, at first, or superficially, alien to me.
Is part of writing a character, getting to know a character, also liking him too? And I'm thinking about Owen Brown, who you say is so different from yourself.
I don't think you have to like your characters, your major characters, but I think you have to forgive them.
Forgive them.
Well, forgive them for being who they are. I think it would be very difficult to summon up a major character, to create a major character. who you could not really feel for on a serious level. That's what I mean by the necessity to forgive them. I think you have got to give them your blessing. You've got to accept them in spite of their problems.
You went to a Catholic school for some time in as a kid growing up in New York City. And yet it seemed as if, from what I read, that you fought against what they were teaching, I guess, whether it has to do with morality or spirituality. Can you describe what that early schooling was like for you?
Well, I started very young with the Marist Order, an order of teaching brothers. I went to one of their boarding schools when I was still 5 years old, and I spent the years 5 to 8 there. I absorbed a lot of religion very young, and I believed in it absolutely, and it became, and it remains, I suppose, a way of perceiving. It's something that you really cannot get rid of. For all your embracing of rationality and rationalism, you cannot really lose the religious conditioning. I reacted against it when I was in high school. I reacted against my religious teachers, because I really found a great deal in the Catholicism of the late 50s that I found repugnant and that I wanted to fight against. I left religion. I walked away from the Catholic religion about at the age of 16 with a great sense of liberation. What I didn't realize at the time, but have come to realize since, is that I walked away with half my head missing. I was liberated, but there was an enormous hole where large parts of me should have been that was swept away with that divorce.
Does that mean you've become a Catholic?
No, but I think I've remained a Jansenist. The Jansenist tradition of Catholicism was really the one I was raised in. In Jansenism, it is very, very difficult to be saved. It is all you can do to overcome your innate depravity. Original sin looms enormously around you. And I think, in a way, I for years I fought against that as undue pessimism, that horror of original sin. And then at a certain point, I don't know when, it began to seem to me to be, in a certain sense, true, independent of theological systems. There was something true about that. The necessity of behaving well and the great difficulty of it, the way in which so many parts of so many human impulses drive us against accepting a common condition with other people. This seemed to me to make enormous sense symbolically. And I think, even though I've stopped being a Catholic, I'm probably still a Jansenist.
I'm speaking with novelist Robert Stone, and he's written many novels, including A Hall of Mirrors, Dog Soldiers, which received a National Book Award, A Flag for Sunrise, Children of Light. And his latest book is called Outer Bridge Reach. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with novelist Robert Stone, and his latest book is called Outer Bridge Reach. I want to talk a little bit more about your growing up. Your mother was schizophrenic. She was a school teacher for a while and then lost her job because of her schizophrenia. What kind of a mother was she to you?
She was very affectionate. She was really, in her way, very caring. She was rather difficult to deal with sometimes. And she was also embarrassing to me. And I used to tell other kids when they met her that she was deaf, just trying to explain the kind of inappropriate responses and strange connections that she would make with things. But she was very well read. She was an educated woman. When she lost her job in the school system, things became very tight. I mean, our circumstances were much reduced, and she made her living hand addressing envelopes, paid by the thousand envelopes.
So you grew up poor?
Pretty poor. We had money week to week. She was paid by the thousand envelopes that she addressed. She had a very small pension from the school system, about $90 a month. And the rest was what she made hand addressing envelopes. Her hands became very crippled, that they became very twisted and arthritic as a result of doing this, just writing from 9 to 5 in longhand, addressing in longhand.
Did you worry about her as a child?
I worried about her and I worried about us. I mean, at one time we were reported to the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. Which was ridiculous, really, because she, one thing she wasn't was abusive. But somebody got the wrong idea. So we found ourselves having to appear before the Children's Protective Society. And she picked this time to wear two different colored shoes. I mean, she had a brown shoe and a white shoe, which I didn't spot until we got there. I was around 11. And we'd come past the holding tank for kids who had been taken away from their their keepers, from their parents. And the kids in there looked to me pretty tough. I didn't want to end up in there. And so I had to sort of do a little song and dance and try and distract the people from spotting her two different colored shoes. I mean, this kind of thing went on. I mean, in a way, it was it wasn't always heavy and gruesome. It was really never heavy and gruesome. It was pretty bearable and pretty light.
So how did you distract them from her two-colored shoes?
Just by talking a lot, I think.
Well, did she have hallucinations?
Yeah, she had audio hallucinations. She used to hear things. She'd get into strange colloquies with voices from the past. One thing it did to me was make me really closely examine my attitude toward reality, because hers was quite arbitrary, and there were times when I felt like I might somehow be drawn into hers.
Well, were you able to as a child enter her hallucinations? I mean, be able to talk to her about what she was hearing?
Yes, I could. There is a certain quality to schizophrenic speech and logic, which is recognizable if you've seen a lot of it. It has a curious, difficult to describe savor. One runs into it from time to time, and I can spot it because I remember it from a person who I lived on intimate terms with for years and years.
Is she still alive?
No, she died in 1971.
Robert Stone is my guest, and his latest book is called Outer Bridge Reach. Now, how did you meet Ken Kesey?
In 1962, I got a Stegner Fellowship on the basis of the beginning of my first novel. The Stegner Fellowships were granted by Stanford to support works in progress if they thought the works were worthy. And I was beginning A Hall of Mirrors, my first book. And I sent part of it to Stanford, and Stanford said, come out. So we moved out. I was married at that time, and still am. And my wife got a job key punching in Silicon Valley, and I went to classes at Stanford. And at that time, a lot of people I ran into were living in a little corner of Menlo Park, California, around a street called Perry Lane, and I began to go over there to visit and party. And that's where I met Kesey. Kesey was living on Perry Lane at that time. He had just been working as an orderly in the Veterans Hospital at Palo Alto, and he was at that time at work on Sometimes a Great Notion, his second novel.
Well, you did a lot of drugs then, a lot of hallucinogenic drugs. How did that change your view of reality? And we were talking earlier about your mother's schizophrenia as a way of kind of entering another kind of reality. Did drugs give you another way to get into another kind of reality?
Yes, in a way they did. They certainly explained a number of things to me about delusional systems. They also seemed to confirm certain attitudes toward life and the world that I had, I think, drawn from my religious phase, it seemed to me that there were underlying mysteries that had to be accepted, that could not be reasoned aside. I mean, in terms of the intellectual content of those psychedelic trips, I think that was one thing that came to me, the sense of underlying mysteries.
Why did you stop taking drugs?
Well, for one thing, I think at a certain point it becomes frightening. It also becomes a lot of work. I mean, to take those psychedelics in those days, I mean, you were gone for 12 hours. You could wake up in the morning and your jaws hurt. You had no idea why, and you'd realize that because you'd been smiling from 10 o'clock in the morning until 10 o'clock at night. It was a lot of work. It took a lot of energy. And at a certain point, I think, you know, you think, do I really want to experience the rebirth of the universe when I instead might go down and shoot some pool, you know, or swim a couple of laps? I think you just unless there's some, you know, unholy fascination there that you cannot leave alone, and I think that happened to some people in the early 60s.
There's something that you said I want to ask you about, and this is talking about Outer Bridge Reach, your latest book, and you say it's really a continuation of the same themes that I've always dealt with, the ways in which people come through for each other or fail to, and the ways in which people are always offering something more than they can deliver. Do you feel like you're writing that those are the themes that you've been writing about?
Yes, about what one person seeks from another, the ways in which we seem to promise things that we can't always deliver on. The way in which we're stuck with each other for company, for love, for everything. We have only each other, which is, and that's both the problem and its resolution. This ongoing process where we share the world with other people. I mean, in one vision it's hell, in another aspect it's great.
Well, Robert Stone, I thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, too.
Robert Stone's latest novel is called Outer Bridge Reach. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about today's show. Hi, Linda. What do you have for us?
Hi, Marty. We are going to be talking about the campaign for a bit. The campaign appears to be heating up. It's moved down south, and things are getting a little bit rough. We'll have several stories. We have a long discussion of the Cuban community and increased incidence of AIDS and special problems that community is having, facing the disease. A report from Ted Clark on the peace conference, the Arab-Israeli peace conference, and a report on the tradition of Black celebration of Mardi Gras New Orleans.
Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered, coming up from National Public Radio. England's Dreaming is a line in a song by the late punk rock group, the Sex Pistols. It's also the title of a new book by British music journalist John Savage, subtitled Anarchy, Sex Pistols, Punk Rock, and Beyond. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review.
John Savage's story begins with Malcolm McLaren, a cocky entrepreneur steeped in leftist art theory, who opened a clothing store in London in the mid-70s called Sex. Along with his partner, the fashion designer Vivian Westwood, McLaren was out to provoke. They marketed bondage clothing as leisure wear. They ripped T-shirts to give them a look that matched the stress that England's economy was undergoing. Sex became a popular hangout for young bohemians who were looking for a pop scene that involved something more daring than Rod Stewart or the Bee Gees. As Savage tells it in England's Dreaming, this gave McLaren the idea to invent his own rock band. He wasn't really interested in revolutionizing rock. He just wanted, he told Savage, to sell a lot of trousers. So the Sex Pistols were created, ordered up, sort of like the Monkees. But the Pistols were conceived in what Savage calls a miasma of antagonism, misunderstanding, and mutual suspicion. In other words, angry guys for an angry time. singer John Lydon, who took the name Johnny Rotten, guitarist Steve Jones, bassist Glenn Matlock, and drummer Paul Cook were working-class kids, and they didn't see much hope in an England where, by 1977, 1.6 million people, most of them under the age of 30, were unemployed. Throughout England's dreaming, Savage uses Margaret Thatcher and her economic policies the way Melville used Moby Dick, as a constant menacing presence, seen or unseen. The Pistols took the basic idea McLaren had, to make a splash by attacking everything around them, and really ran with it, because as it turned out, the Pistols made great music. God Save the Queen, the Pistols' second single, was a whirlwind of feedback guitars and Johnny Rotten's buzzsaw whine. The song was released in May of 77 to coincide with the celebration of Queen Elizabeth's Silver Jubilee. But this salute referred to the Queen as the helpless symbol of a, quote, fascist regime. That did the trick. Banned by the BBC, condemned in both the straight press and the tabloids, God Save the Queen was, Savage writes, confident, clear, unapologetic, so much so that it gave a voice to everybody who hated the Jubilee, and there were many more of them than would ever be officially acknowledged. By January of 78, less than 7 months later, the Sex Pistols had broken up. Their seething hatred of everything, including the very idea of the Sex Pistols, made them implode. But they also touched off an explosion of new pop culture. England's Dreaming is full of precise reporting and humorous details. I love finding out that when he was a kid, Steve Jones stole a color TV out of Keith Richards' mansion. I myself interviewed John Lydon once, not long after the Sex Pistols broke up. It was in a hotel room in Los Angeles, and standing on a balcony that overlooked Sunset Boulevard, Lydon insisted on calling me Kentucky, and he poured a bottle of Coke onto the head of a man standing on the sidewalk below him. It was the most nerve-wracking and annoying interview I've ever done, but it was worth it because John Lydon explained himself. It is my desire, he said, very slowly, very precisely, to work people into a state of gibbering rage, because then, if only for those few moments, they cannot lead their usual boring, sedentary lives. Spoken like a true brat, I thought at the time. Spoken like a true artist, I'm reminded now, after reading John Savage's terrific book.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed England's Dreaming by John Savage, published by St. Martin's Press. Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller with Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Roberta Shorrock, and Joan Tuohy. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Our research assistant is Ellen Silva. I'm Marty Moskowain.
God save the Queen! The fascist regime! It made you a moron! Potential hate!
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk to documentary filmmaker Frederick Wiseman about his film, Titicat Follies. The film about abuses at a state mental hospital was banned for more than two decades. Now the ban's been lifted and the film is being shown. Also, we'll talk with comic actor Rowan Atkinson of Blackadder fame. That and more on the next Fresh Air.